Translation and purport. Shukadev Goswami said, O King, having thus been praised by the Supreme Personality, who bears the mark of Srivats on his chest, Lord Shiva circumambulated him. Then, after taking permission from him, Lord Shiva returned to his abode, Kailash, along with his associates. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that when Lord Shiva was offering obeisances unto Lord Vishnu, Lord Vishnu arose and embraced him. Therefore, the word Srivatsankena is used here. The mark of Srivats adorns the chest of Lord Vishnu. And therefore, when Lord Vishnu embraced Lord Shiva while being circumambulated, the Srivats mark touched Lord Shiva's bosom. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Priste Bhutale Sri Mante Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pachayane Nirvisesa Sunyavadi Pastidade Starine Sri Sukha Uvacha Imam Bhagavata Rajan Srivatsankena Satkrit Amantriyatam Parikramya Sagana Svalayam Yayu. So here in the purport, Prabhupada raises a question about why the name Srivats is used for the Lord. There's a meaning to the name. It means the Lord has on his breast a curl of hair. And the question is, why is this name used? This name is commented on by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And Prabhupada had that commentary with him when he was translating these verses. You know, late at night he worked, early in the morning he worked on translating it. The book that he translated from had commentaries of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and others, Sridhar Swami. So he could choose some of their comments to include in his purport, and that's what he did here. He says that Vishwanath Chakravarti says that when Lord Shiva was offering obeisances and preparing to take his leave, he circumambulated Vishnu. And then Lord Vishnu stood up and embraced him. And this Srivats mark on his chest touched the bosom of Lord Shiva. So there's actually a lot of details about this Srivats mark. I found a lot of description of this in the Vedabase. It's a curl of fine hair. It's on the upper portion of the right side of the chest. And the hair curls from left to right, in case you were wondering. That detail is there. The hair curls from the left to the right. And the color of the hair is described as either yellow or silver or white. It's a light color, in other words. And the chest of the Lord is dark blackish blue. So the streaks of the hair stand out. And Prabhupada compared this to the streaks that appear on a stone for testing gold. Apparently in India, people will scrape the gold across a black stone, rub it, to test the density of the gold or the value of the gold. And it looks beautiful on the stone. The black stone has these gold streaks. So this is the comparison made. And it says the Lord's chest surpasses the beauty of that testing stone for gold, which looks nice. In Vaikuntha, this Srivats mark distinguishes Lord Vishnu from the other residents of Vaikuntha who have the same bodily features. they've attained the liberation of having the same form as the Lord, forearms and same complexion. So this mark and a few other symptoms distinguish Lord Vishnu. Srivats itself, the word itself means Shri and Goddess Lakshmi, and Vats, where she's sitting, her sitting place. So she sits beside the Lord's chest. She's his companion. And Srivats means that. Lakshmi. It's an emblem for Lakshmi. Jai Sisi Radha Gokulananda. There's another explanation of this in connection with the Kastuba gem, which is worn by the Lord. The Kastuba gem is hanging from a necklace right about where the Srivats mark is. And sometimes the two of those are discussed together. The Kastuba gem is said to represent the pure spirit soul, and the Srivats mark represents the effulgence of the pure spirit soul. There's more details about this Kastuba gem. We'll turn our attention for a few minutes to the Sri Vaishnav tradition, where this is described in more detail. The Chaitanya Vaishnavs have 12 Mahajans, and the Sri Vaishnavs have 12 Alvars, great personalities. The Tamil word Alvar means someone who's drowned in love of God, someone who's very advanced spiritually. So the Sri Vaishnavs recognize these Alvars. They lived from as far back as 5,000 years before the current era, all the way into like about 1,000 years ago. One in particular was talked about by Srila Prabhupada. His name was King Kulashekar. These Alvars are considered to be extraordinary living entities, not ordinary jivas. They're incarnations of the Lord's paraphernalia. And you might wonder, well, how can the paraphernalia of the Lord be a person? But that's something about the spiritual world that Srila Prabhupada taught us, that everything in the spiritual world is a conscious living being. There's no dull matter. So even the Lord's paraphernalia, like the Kastuba gem, is a person. The technical word is parshadas, the paraphernalia of the Lord. And these paraphernalia sometimes incarnate to assist the Lord. So in the case of King Kulashekar, his father didn't have any children. He was praying to Lord Vishnu, and the Lord blessed the king that he could have a son who was a plenary portion of the Kastuba gem. Certainly a special child. The verse that King Kulashekar wrote that Srila Prabhupada quoted the most often was Krishna Tvadiya Pada Pankaja Panjarantam. That's the first line. Krishna Tvadiya Pada Pankaja Panjarantam. Means it's a prayer to Krishna. It means let the royal swan of my mind now enter the tangled stems of the lotus of your feet. How will it be possible for me to remember you at the time of death when my throat will be choked up with mucus, bile, and air? So at the time of death, the body is disturbed, and King Kulashekar is afraid that he won't be able to remember the Lord. So he asks the Lord, please now let me absorb my mind in remembrance of you. Just like a swan likes to twirl his long neck around the stems of the lotus flower, he'll dip into the water with his neck and with his neck, become entangled in the stems of the lotus. So he said, let the royal swan of my mind enter the stems of the lotus of your feet, and then I can remember you now. Maybe I can leave my body now, is the idea. So Prabhupada liked that verse very much and quoted it a lot. The whole dynasty of King Kulashekar was royal, but they didn't consider themselves the lords of the country where they lived. They considered themselves the servants of the deity in the temple where they lived. In the case of one temple, the deity there is Ananta Padmanabha Swami. This is in the place where King Kulashekar's dynasty lived, Ananta Padmanabha Swami. This is in Kerala, in the city of Trivandrum. And the deity resides on Sesha. He's lying, Vishnu is lying on Sesha. And from his lotus navel, there's a flower, lotus flower growing, and Brahma is seated on the lotus flower. So you see this if you go to the temple. It's quite a big altar, and not a small deity. I was there for several weeks, and I would visit this temple quite often. This temple has recently been in the news, the Sri Padmanabha Swami temple. The understanding is that in these temples, Vishnu is living. He's the proprietor. He can actually own property. The deity can own property. So his property is taken care of by guardians. So in the case of King Kulashekar and the other kings in that line, they regarded themselves as the guardians of the property of Lord Vishnu. And recently the treasure vaults, the vaults that hold the treasures of the deity, the wealth of the deity, the vaults, the news came that these vaults were holding a lot of treasure. The government became involved because they suspected that the current servants in the temple were maybe tampering with the Lakshmi or the gold in these treasure vaults. And they got some government representatives to go there when the vaults were opened to watch the servants. So this happened in October 2008. Two government servants were watching as one vault was opened, not so long ago, just 5 years. And inside they saw that there were so many dazzling objects made of gold. There was a golden bow and golden arrows and umbrellas made out of gold. The handles of the umbrellas were just made of solid gold. There was a gold throne for the deity, which had many precious gems embedded in it. There were small murtis of Vishnu lying down on Sesha, made of solid gold. One of these murtis of Vishnu weighs 32 kilos or 70 pounds. That's solid gold. So that's worth a lot. And the value that's being put on these treasury items is like in around $20 billion worth of treasure in these vaults. And this exceeds the wealth of the current, what is currently the richest temple in India, Tirupati. So I'm bringing this up because this is an example of Lakshmi being engaged in the service of Vishnu. We said that Lakshmi is always with Vishnu, seated at the chest of Vishnu. So here's some proof. Lord Vishnu is not a poor man. And in this pastime that we were reading about Lord Shiva and Mohini Murti, we have another case of the Lord's internal energy, the female energy of the Lord, Mohini Murti, bewildering Shiva. So she's engaged in that way. The Lord wanted to bewilder Shiva, and his internal energy took that role of Mohini Murti to lead Lord Shiva around like a very lusty person. Of course, usually Lord Shiva is very Krishna conscious. He's married to Durga. She's in charge of the illusory energy in this world. She can give anybody any amount of wealth in this world. But we know Lord Shiva lives under a tree. Why does he have such a simple residence? Why doesn't he have a very opulent residence? He could have anything. Prabhupada says because Lord Shiva is Krishna conscious, he doesn't consider the wealth of this world to be for his enjoyment. He knows that all the opulence in this world is meant for Lord Vishnu. So he's Krishna conscious, like King Kulashekar and the dynasty of the Alvars. They were just considering themselves caretakers of the Lord's wealth. There's another example in the Nectar of Devotion of Lord Shiva becoming bewildered, or captivated, at least captivated, by the consorts of Krishna. I'll read this, it's just one paragraph. This is in the qualities of Sri Krishna. The quality being described is self-controlled. Krishna is self-controlled. A person who can control his senses fully is called self-controlled. In this connection, it's stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, all the 16,000 wives of Krishna were so exquisitely beautiful that their smiling and shyness were able to captivate the minds of great demigods like Lord Shiva. But still, they could not even agitate the mind of Krishna in spite of their attractive feminine behavior. That's from the Bhagavatam. Then Srila Prabhupada writes, every one of the thousands of wives of Krishna was thinking that Krishna was captivated by her feminine beauty, but this was not the case. Krishna is therefore the supreme controller of the senses. And this is admitted in Bhagavad Gita, where he is addressed as Rishikesh, the master of the senses. So this is a day on the Vaishnav calendar in which we celebrate the appearance anniversary of Sri Lalita. She's another internal energy of Krishna. Rupa Goswami offered prayers, wrote prayers to Lalita. I can read a few of these. I offer my obeisances to Lalita Devi, who has many wonderful qualities. She acts boldly out of intense feelings of friendship for Sri Radha Mukunda. Her face defeats the beauty of the full moon, and she's expert in the art of decorating Sri Radhika. She's like one of these beauticians, you know, at the haircutting shop. She can fix Radharani's hair and so on. Lalita teaches Sri Radhika the art of being a left-wing heroine. What's that? Well, she instructs Radha, Radhe, firmly reject this shrewd son of the king of Vraj, Krishna. Don't be weak. I'm saying it for your own good. Don't submit to him. So she teaches Radharani the mood of defying Krishna. Lalita's eyes become red with anger if she sees Krishna cheating Sri Radhika. Then, Lalita promptly embarrasses Krishna with her clever words. So she argues with Krishna and embarrasses him if he cheats Radharani. Lalita is affectionate toward Yashoda, the queen of the cowherds. Lalita is the teacher of the art of friendship for all the Sakis, all the girlfriends of Radharani. She teaches them the art of friendship. And her love for Sri Radha and Krishna is equal. She requests every girl in Vraj to join the party of Vishabhanu's daughter. And she fulfills all the desires, of Sri Radhika. She's the chief of Srimati Radharani's dear girlfriends. She always enjoys the festival of Radhika and Vrajendra Sutta's meeting. Vrajendra Sutta is a name of Krishna, means the son of the king of Vraj. So this is a description of the spiritual world. Also in Brahma Samhita we hear about these Lakshmis, many, many uncountable Lakshmis in the spiritual world. And each morning also when we greet the deities, here we hear Govindadasi singing a verse from the Brahma Samhita. Okay, Jamuna. My fault. Jamuna. So what's she singing? She's singing Angani yasya sakalendriya vriti manti pasyanti panti kalayanti chiranjaganti. What does that describe? Yes, it describes beautiful forms, but the limbs, yes. And what does it say about the limbs? Yes, the limbs of Krishna are multipotent. Any one of the limbs of Krishna, any part of the body of Krishna, can do the function of any of the other parts. So what does that mean? That means there's a difference between being spiritually embodied and materially embodied. I can't create children unless the sexual organs are engaged. But Krishna can create the living entities by glancing over the material energy. He impregnates the material energy with his glance, and the living entities in this world then enter the womb of the material energy and become embodied. Also, from his navel, he creates Brahma without the help of any consort. He can create Brahma just by himself on the lotus navel flower. Prabhupada gave other examples of this multipotency. If Krishna's being offered some food by the devotee, how does Krishna eat it? He can eat by hearing the prayers of the devotee, asking that Krishna accept the offering, by hearing. He can eat by seeing the offering. So he's multipotent. Any part, one part of the body can do the functions of all the others. So a spiritual body has quite a different character than a material body. Our bodies are temporary, and when we try to enjoy, we increase our bondage in the cycle of birth and death, and we increase our ignorance by identifying with the body. But when Krishna identifies with his body, engages in conjugal love affairs, there's no such effect. There's no bondage, there's no ignorance. Those who engage in conjugal love affairs with Krishna are concerned about Krishna's satisfaction. They're not concerned with their own enjoyment. So it's said that one who properly hears about these affairs will have lust driven from his heart. If one hears about the spiritual love affairs of Krishna and the gopis, then lust will be driven from his heart. So we have to understand properly that the affairs, the conjugal affairs of Krishna, are not mundane, temporary affairs that cause ignorance or bondage, but they can be conducted in a wholly different way, because the spiritual body is so different from the material body. With Krishna, just by seeing Radharani or just by smelling the fragrance of Radharani's perfumes, he can enjoy fully. He can have this same complete enjoyment that would normally come from having a sexual relationship in the mundane sense. All the satisfaction of a conjugal relationship can be had with just Krishna seeing Radharani or the gopis, or smelling the fragrance of their bodies, sidelong glances. So this is how these loving affairs are described in the Shastras. They're not described as illicit sexual affairs, because the spiritual body works in a completely different way than the material body. So that's important to understand. As we're approaching Radhastami, we shouldn't think Krishna and Radharani are engaged in ordinary affairs like boys and girls. Okay, let's see if you have any questions.